Off the Ball. GAA.
The game is in a state of evolution at the minute, a state of flux. It's constantly evolving. There may be little tweaks needed, but I don't really fully get why they changed what we had last year.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Off the Ball.
Been a brilliant day's sport. Michael McCarthy is here with me in studio. Hello, Mick.
Hi, Owen.
You enjoyed the RDS last night?
Loved it. Yeah, it was great. I'd never been in the venue before. It was the concert hall in the RDS, which I'd never been, which is surrounded by books from, I would say, at least 1,000 years ago that haven't been. You would be afraid to touch it in case it would disintegrate.
Did you leaf through any of them, actually?
I was afraid to take any of them out, to be honest. I did once take a book from the Ginger Man pub in Pear Street, much to my eternal shame, right? But it was just an automatic thing. It was in my pocket before I realised what I was doing. And then got on the Nightlink and opened it and went, oh, Count of Monte Cristo, and just read it on the way home and then kept reading it.
It was a long old bus journey. Got it all done on the way home.
I don't think I finished it or anything, but it was a good book. But didn't do that last night. And I suppose I've taken us on a wild tangent there. But
I think I saw a gap in the bookshelf in the Ginger Man last time I was in there. So any staff members, you know,
they haven't refilled their bookshelf in a good 15, 20 years then, if that's the case. It was a really fun night, I have to say. You mentioned Mike Tindall, you mentioned Anna and Eve, who were all great. We'll hear them tonight. And our Bumper Six Nations preview, which we'll do, we'll play on the show as a Bumper Six Nations preview next week. Starring Andy Dunn, Alan Quinlan, and without a doubt, Mr. Zinger, Andrew Trimble. It was at one point where he'd only talked 5 times and each one of them were like, you know, had the place like bent over laughing. He was absolutely brilliant.
He's a very, very funny man. And we get to do it all over again with Andrew Trimble in a few weeks' time as well, because we're going up to Belfast to do a show with himself and Stephen Ferris. So got a lovely little taster of Andrew last night. He was absolutely brilliant.
He was superb. He's a lovely guy anyway, as people, like, he's one of those people that you, when you hear on media, you already know, like, that's the real guy, and you can tell that he's a lovely fella. But my God, his timing for a few jokes, usually about being Protestant, let's face it. His timing was superb.
So loads coming on that front tonight. The Mike Tindall chat, very, very good. Himself and Brian O'Driscoll, born within 3 or 4 months of one another, and they make their Six Nations debut on the very same afternoon. A terrible day for Irish rugby, but a great day for Mike Tindall, who does this kind of swan dive into the corner.
Yeah.
Swan dive is maybe being generous.
On commentary, when we play it during the piece, on commentary, like, Stuart Barnes is losing his mind about what an amazing dive it was. And you look at it now and it's like, I think Chris Ashton, you know, probably knew how to do a dive a little bit better. Yeah. But that game is really interesting to me. And me and you talked about it a little bit during the week. That game, it's funny. It's England hammering Ireland. It's Mike Tindall's debut, etc. It's obviously setting them on the path to, you know, not winning the 3 Grand Slams before they finally did in 03 and then go and win the World Cup. So it's such a pivotal point in England's development to the greatest moment in their rugby history, and it's also probably the most important match in Irish history, because we had this, like, it was, if you look at that and Ireland getting hammered that day, that's the last day, that's the last match of the old days, that's the last it's in 2000, but it's the last match of the grim wooden spoon 90s. And then after that, Gatland makes the shift the following week, brings in the Munster players. It's Stringer, O'Gara, Foley, Shane Horgan, not Munster, but, you know, in the same spirit. And those guys come in to join, like, the Mick Galway, Peter Clottesy, and suddenly there's a new core of the Irish team, mixture of youth and experience, based on the province, of the form of the provinces. And the old days are out the window, and suddenly it's like guys that were, you know, playing in England, you know, who were coming over and playing for, it was just gone. You know, and it's for all the argument we have of whether we should be only picking players in Ireland or not, it's never been madly an issue since. There's never been a load of players playing over in England or in France that we think should be in the Ireland team, because that model was almost set up after that. It's such a pivotal turning point. And obviously you had Brian about to become a superstar in a few weeks' time in Paris. It was already kind of like a person you should probably be building this team around. You add Rog and Stringer into that and it got us a decade. And the Grand Slam like 9 years later.
Yeah, very true. And the punctuation points on that journey are fascinating as well, which Mike and Brian would have been a big part of. Like, 2004 will be a part of the conversation in the next hour as well, and that certainly, whenever we do these shows and look back through it, consistently comes up. Ireland's refusal to give England a guard of honour as world champions, and Ireland going out and beating them that season, and of course Croke Park 3 years later, and just the feeling of, oh, we deserve to be on the stage alongside a team of this calibre, the world champions. So fascinating chat coming your way from 8 p.m. on today's sport, and kind of looking ahead to the weekend as well. We'll get to the Premier League in just a moment, but it's very, very hard not to start with matters down under, because this was just an extraordinary day of Australian Open semi-final action, one of the best Australian Open semi-final days in history, I would venture. So for me, the big story is Novak Djokovic. We'll be speaking to Luke Jensen later on, who maybe sees Carlos Alcaraz as just as big a story, but Djokovic is now the oldest man in the Open era to reach the Australian Open final. It's his 11th Australian Open final and 38th Grand Slam final overall. So he's extended his record in both of those latter two categories. And Grand Slam number 25 is on the line on Sunday. It will be an extraordinary mark on what's already been an incredible career, because a lot of us have kind of written Djokovic out of the picture. We'd been used to the Alcaraz and Sinner duopoly. We expected that to be the matchup on Sunday, but that was not the case. Earlier this week, have a listen to this, Novak Djokovic was asked about that presumption, basically, about, you know, the fact that he might be the third wheel in what is developing into a great young rivalry between Alcaraz and Sinner, and he didn't take the questioning too well.
When you first, well, in the early part of your career, when you were chasing Roger and Rafa for titles, and now at the back end of your career, you're chasing Yannick and Carlos.
Is it? I'm chasing Yannick and Carlos. In which sense?
In terms of winning Grand Slam titles, just right now.
So I'm always the chaser, and I'm never being chased. So
in the meantime, you won 24 Grand Slams. But I'm saying it's
thanks. It's worth saying that sometimes, right?
Sorry, I should have.
Yeah, yeah. No worries.
So what I'm saying is it possible to compare the way you felt initially when you were chasing Roger and Rafa with now when Yannick and Carlos have split the last 8 slams?
Well, I find it a little bit disrespectful that you kind of miss out on what happened in between, where the times when I started chasing, as you say, Rafa and Roger, and now that I'm chasing Carlos and Yannick, and there's probably about 15-year period in between where I was dominating the Grand Slam. So I think it's important to put that in prospect and in perspective. I don't feel like I'm chasing, to be honest. You know, Roger and Rafa will always be my greatest rivals. I have tremendous respect for what Yannick and Carlos are doing, and they continue to do, and they will do for the next 10 to 15, 20 years. God knows how many years they're going to play. They're so young. And this is a kind of a natural cycle in sports. You know, you're going to have another two superstars that are going to maybe have another third guy, you know, that I'm going to cheer for, because I've always been the third guy at the beginning. But this, it's good for our sport. You know, I think these kind of rivalries and the contrast of the personalities and the styles of play are very good for tennis. And how is that affecting me? As I said, I don't feel like I'm chasing. I'm creating my own history. And I think, you know, I've been very clear when I say that my intention is always to, in terms of achievements and objectives and results, I want to get to the championship match in every tournament, particularly slams. And those slams are, you know, one of the biggest reasons why I keep on competing and playing tennis. So yeah, I mean, that's all I can say. I mean, are they better right now than me and mostly and all other guys? Yes, they are. I mean, the quality and the level is amazing. It's great. It's phenomenal. But does that mean that I walk out with the white flag? No. I mean, I'm going to fight till the last shot, till the last point, and do my very best to challenge them.
I think that's really interesting insight at this juncture, the non-acceptance to walk out with the white flag. And look, maybe their question there is totally reasonable, but it just shows the mindset this week where maybe he had been thinking about a question like that. Maybe he has seen all this talk of a great new rivalry and there being only two real players in men's tennis worth caring about. He's certainly got a lot to say still at this point.
Yeah, I find the disrespect weird. Like, and that's just the way sports people are. They're so single-minded. Like, he went on a long answer and backed up the point and said, like, when a third person comes along, I'll cheer because I'm always the third person in the rivalry. It's like, exactly. That's the question. Anyway, it's so interesting that he backed that up by going out and win. Like, don't forget, like, Djokovic was out of the tournament like 3-4 days ago. Is the guy he's playing gets injured. That happened to Sinner at Wimbledon. You remember? I was watching that live thinking there's literally no way back here. Guy gets injured. He goes on to win it. Like, there is a kind of a moment there that kind of makes you think about Sunday and whether, you know, it's written, the name's written on the cup, I suppose. It's funny with Djokovic. I was thinking there when we were watching this morning about how people stay on long enough that the villains eventually become heroes. And I don't know when it happens, but it's at some point the big dominant, even a bit of Mourinho the other night maybe, but like, you know, at some point the dominant bad guy that nobody wants to win, who wins all around him, stays on long enough that we start to want it. And you start to want to see it. And I wonder, is that happening with Djokovic? At the moment? Because I have to say, there was, even in the office this morning, there was a few people kind of going, are we kind of about it.
The whole office was...
Well, by the end of the fifth set, that was the case. But earlier on, it was almost like over the course of the match, people became Djokovic fans.
Yeah.
And I think that's an incredible thing in sport when that happens. And there is the old warrior aspect of it. That is one of the great stories of sport that continues to happen. When that happens, I do feel like it's always one of those great stories, like, you know.
And this is the first time where he'll have that level of support for him. Not that it matters to him, but it's just interesting in the storyline. It'll be the first time that he's had this level of support probably since much, much earlier in his career. Maybe the first couple of slams where he was that third wheel and you were rooting for the outsider. But certainly since he became the big dog in tennis, I certainly have not rooted for him at any point until today. And today feels significant for that. And that's why Sunday is massive in terms of the narrative around Djokovic. But it's also massive for him to exceed Margaret Court and to get to 25. They're level on 24 apiece right now. He's already broken all the records from a men's standpoint. But to be the overall Grand Slam leader on 25 and a nice kind of round number on 25 as well would mean quite a lot as well. And here's the thing. People will start writing the sort of end of career narratives about Djokovic as well on Sunday, win or lose. But you listen to him there and you kind of think to yourself, God, he's going to have a good season here. He's going to keep going for a little bit longer.
Yeah, I don't know if 25 if would necessarily round it off. It's going to be really hard even this week to get past Sinner and Alcaraz in the same tournament. And he's going to always have to do that, it seems, because it doesn't seem like those lads are going out before the semi-finals at any point. So, and he hasn't even done it yet here. So just kind of remember that it's not a guarantee, but the fact is he's still relevant and the fact is he's still a danger. And there's nobody else seems to be. There's nobody else that's, well, obviously came very close this morning in Alcaraz, but you know, what I was going to say though is one thing that I think is constantly forgotten about every year and underrated is the Australian Open tends to throw up these Friday mornings. I remember like the amount like in the Murray would have loads of them, but those where one would go a full five and you'd be like, wow, that's unbelievable. I can't believe there's another match to come. And then that would be the same thing again. It would go down to the last point. It would go down to five sets. There's something about Australian Open semi-final day that has brought this out many a time over the years.
And it's always and like it's, 4 a.m. in the morning.
Yeah, but goes until about 2 o'clock in the afternoon often. And we always...
Sorry, but I mean 4 a.m. in the morning, Australian time.
In Australian time, of course. Yeah, yeah. It goes like absolutely insanity. Like, what are they all still doing out there? What a weird time to put on games like that could go that way. But yeah, it's like this happens again and again and again. And then every year the Australian Open comes around and we kind of half pay attention to it and then are caught by surprise when suddenly it takes off and becomes the best thing in the world.
So Luke Jensen's going to be up very shortly talking about that. On Sunday here on News Talk, we've got a double helping of brilliant Premier League action as ever. So Tottenham versus Manchester City is our half four game, and Manchester United versus Fulham is the 2 o'clock fixture. I just find this a very, very interesting one. Michael Carrick's first test, where the ball is in your court, sir. So show us what you can do after two fantastic wins, albeit against teams that they were not expected to beat over the last couple of weeks. You've got Leeds at home to Arsenal tomorrow at 3 p.m. as well, and Liverpool versus Newcastle the game that is most improved by being under lights compared to any other fixture in the Premier League.
I said the same thing earlier. That's on, if you listen to the Final One Standing podcast that you were not a part of, I think I might have said something very, very similar.
It's such a great fixture.
But it is. It's one of those, like, you just like, make an 8 o'clock Saturday night fixture just for that.
Hmm.
It's funny how it's like never, ever lived down that one game that happened 30 years ago.
Yeah.
Now, it did finish it, the following season. There was another 4-3, like, you know, so it and it's not as if it hasn't had. Like, remember the Darwin Núñez game a couple of years ago?
The one at the start of the season.
This season, exactly, yeah. It's always had a little bit of something to it. But the one this season was absolutely bananas. Like, but I don't know. That's a weird game for me because you have both those teams. Like, obviously did okay in Europe during the week, but they're both coming off defeats, really disappointing defeats. And Liverpool haven't won yet in the Premier League this year. And shouldn't that be a case of, like, we need to go and, you know, have a Liverpool-Newcastle-style game and go and kill them? But I just wonder, is there an inbuilt conservatism there that'll be like, don't lose this week or we're in big trouble? I don't know. It could affect the game.
Yeah, but I haven't quite considered that. Like, I think one of the things in Liverpool's favour tomorrow evening is that they're up against a Champions League team. It's hard to know. I'm kind of wavering between two sort of conclusions on this. Either that we're overrating the English teams in Europe completely and that actually, you know, the likes of Arsenal, Newcastle, Chelsea, Liverpool, etc. aren't as good as we think they are, and they're not able to, you know, back up a good European performance with a Premier League performance. Or is it actually just down to a little bit of fatigue and a little bit of not being able to back up Wednesday night by going out and being 100% on a Saturday or a Sunday? I see Arteta's out today looking for bigger squads in the Premier League. He's begging the Premier League to go from 20 to 23 in terms of the numbers of players on a matchday squad.
Yeah, why?
For the value of players and the mental health of players, and bigger matchday squads in terms of what they use in the Champions League, going the same at Premier League.
I just sound like you're only still only going to use five subs. You're not going to have, like, maybe Arteta is possibly the only one that would have use for all of the extra three subs, like, and can make a better choice. I think we're constantly at advantage for the bigger, richer clubs in this regard. Five subs is something. Again, I think the two games a week, I do understand that players are tired and it's non-stop football all the time, but you also have five subs, and you also have, in Arsenal's case in particular, a massive squad. Like, and I don't mean massive in terms of numbers, but I mean massive in terms of depth. Like, they could literally play their second team and it could be as good as any team in the Premier League. Like, you know, so yeah, look, I mean, it's fine. Players are tired. I completely get that. But again, there's three other teams playing in Europe every week as well, going Thursday, Sunday. So that's, now you're on 9 teams out of the 20 in the Premier League. I don't know. And they're all the richest teams, more or less, except for Manchester United, and have the biggest squads and so on. So I think the Champions League teams are probably in a, you know, less worse position than the Europa League teams when it comes to that. Like,
yeah, possibly. What's sticking out to you from the Premier
Leeds
League
and Arsenal?
Yeah,
definitely. Like, it's the first really good Premier League weekend in a while, because you have that Spurs City game is a good half four, and lots of intrigue around that with Spurs' home form and City's away form. Fulham United Fulham is really interesting for what you just mentioned, because Fulham are actually a good side. They're seventh in the table, and they're almost, they're like, for the first front foot game, that's a tough opponent.
Yeah.
You know, so it's really interesting to judge that, and also to judge overreactions, because United could play well and draw that game and it wouldn't be the end of the world at all. And then Liverpool, Newcastle. But then I just think Leeds and Arsenal has everything about it. It's, for me, this is a game that is, if Arsenal win this game, you're mad to think of it against a promoted club. I think that could be the as big a step as they'll take on the way to the league this year. Leeds have lost twice at home this season. I think they were unlucky in both regards. Their form recently would suggest they won't lose at home again. You know, they've been absolutely brilliant in the last 2 months. Even within the run where Arsenal beat them earlier on the season, that's probably their only blip in the last 2 months, 2.5 months. So they've been really, really good. They're really hard to beat. They're also a physical side that I just think... Arsenal didn't play them. They beat them much earlier in the season, 5-0, wasn't it? Yeah, I was confused.
First home game of the season, I think.
Sorry, yeah. So Leeds' last form over the last couple of months have been really well. They're a very, very physical team that I don't think, like Forest a couple of weeks ago, Arsenal won't be able to wear down in the way they do with a lot of teams, and they'll have to beat them. Now they've much better players, but I think Elland Road, Leeds form, Leeds physicality makes this a really tough matchup for Arsenal.
100%. Yeah.
And I think if they go on, it's not to look at it negatively, it's to look at it positively. I think if Arsenal go and win this, it'll be a much bigger result than they'll be given credit for on the day.
Yeah.
If they win it, I don't think everyone in Match of the Day will be talking about how they won the league today, but I think it actually could be that fixture for them.
No, it's one of those where you can see the situation looking incredibly detrimental if it's a draw or defeat at the hands of Leeds United, and then if they win, it's ship steadied, as opposed to going as big and the kind of language you'd use around it in the other direction. So definitely, yeah, it's a real sort of kind of statement opportunity to just say it's not as bad as things maybe seemed last Sunday. Manchester United are a weird team to come up against at the moment. The Emirates may be a weird place in those sorts of scenarios, so you got Elland Road, you win, all is good.
How have you found the discussions this week?
Grand.
Over the top?
No, not at all. Like, in terms of the discussions we've had in the show?
No, just like, I mean in general around Arsenal, like across all media.
What do you mean, like?
It's very doomsday.
Like, Gary Neville set the tone for that on Sunday.
Yeah.
And I agree with him.
Okay.
Like, I think there's, for a team who haven't won in 22 years, like, Gary Neville's not saying that Arsenal are going to crumble.
No,
Gary,
I think they'll win the league, yeah.
He said this could be the sort of destabilising thing. And, like, if Arsenal don't win tomorrow, he's right. Like, it's a lack of stability, because if Manchester City go and win, then all of a sudden you've seen the gap diminish again. So I'm not sure if it's doomsday. I think it's like a fair analysis of like a situation that hasn't been great in the Premier League. Like not winning against Liverpool, not winning against Forest, not scoring against Liverpool, not scoring against Forest, and getting beaten at home by Manchester United. Like they're in bad form in the Premier League.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's doomsday. I think it's like the league leaders are looking vulnerable. Yeah. They might have a title race.
Well, yeah, doomsday doesn't have to be wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. It's funny because I was saying to you before, I've been a little bit reticent about the Arsenal as, you know, you can use whatever word you want, mentally fragile bottlers, not being able to get over the line. There's kinder and meaner ways to say it, right? But all we know where we're coming from. And I've been just a little bit reticent of sort of like, this is a really hard league. They have played better than every other team in the league so far and have a decent lead at the top of the table because of it. It's not going to be plain sailing where you just win every game. It's really difficult. There's a reason none of the, like, you know, United, Chelsea, Liverpool all are in the same position they've been for weeks and weeks and weeks, despite having never won a match up until United started winning a couple of weeks ago. But I thought their reaction after they scored, it went up against United on Sunday, was so peculiar that it's almost like I think there's evidence there now. Whether that evidence is proof or not is a different thing. But, you know, the goal from Zubimendi's mistake was the third chance from a mistake that happened within 3 minutes, I would say, after United scored. And I was like, what's going on here? Like, what's going on? This is not Arsenal. So that would worry me more, and I don't think that's been talked about as much as tactics and style and let the players be free and let them off on a merry dance and create some chances and stuff like that. It's more, is there a fragility there?
Yeah.
And that can be overcome. It absolutely can be overcome. Maybe that's why Arteta had the song and dance moment this week, and maybe that's actually not the worst time for it.
I don't know. Like, I still see the Manchester United thing as kind of a part of a pattern. Like, I think Arsenal, to kind of say they've been the best team in the league is definitely correct, but they haven't been amazing for a long, long time. Like, you go back through all of their results recently, obviously Manchester United, I'm talking about the Premier League here, as I've mentioned, can't score at Forest, don't score at home to Liverpool. The Bournemouth game, unbelievably nervy game. The Aston Villa game, which is right before that, is actually an outlier. Because before that, Brighton scored to bring it back to 2-1.
And it was a second-half performance in the Emirates
It was very, very nervous, sort of, at last 20-25 minutes against Brighton because they got that goal back 2-1. They win by the odd goal 1-0 away to Everton. The Wolves game is the one before that. Arsenal are very lucky to get 3 points against one of the worst historical teams.
Yeah, yeah.
The game before that is the Villa Park game. The game before that was a grand performance against a Brentford team that had rested one or two of their best players. The game before that is Chelsea, when they go to the Bridge, Caicedo gets sent off. Not a great performance. The game before that is the North London Derby. So you've got to go all the way back to the North London Derby. The only performance that I would say has been a very good performance by Arsenal since then has been the Villa game.
But the one thing you would take from that is that was
they haven't played well for 3 months.
That was a chips down game, though, wasn't it? Like that was you could only do that every now and then, and you can only say, right, this is a statement performance, and they came out with it, you know. So
I think there's a chance that basically, if Arsenal don't win the league, it's been a slow decline from a very, very impressive start to the season, as opposed to a massive destabilising
one moment
that happened in late January.
Yeah, but I suppose the destabilising thing for me isn't from what I'm talking about those three chances and the goal. It's more that I'm saying is like there's evidence there then that something is affecting them. But that is obviously not just happening for 2 minutes in a game. That's happening constantly. Like, that is part of the makeup of the team, perhaps.
And it brings you back into the Champions League thing. Why have they been, like, genuinely excellent then in the Champions League? Why has there been such a Jekyll and Hyde thing? That's something we will discuss in the coming weeks, I'm sure, when the Champions League does return.
When they win 4-0 tomorrow, we'll just forget about it.
Well, that would be quite something if they were to go to Elland Road and win 4-0. I'd be highly suspicious that that'll be the case.
Off the ball.